in the fact sheet, you'll see the revenue amounts are a little bit higher because they did include the fishing license increase, and so we wouldn't, of course, propose that again. So if you look at what just those proposed increases in the surcharge would bring in, they would bring in about close to $3.9 million a year, which is similar to a little bit more than the general fund change item that's been submitted through the governor's process, but a very similar amount.
Thank you. Just as people are expressed some interest in this, I don't know how much interest there truly is, but some interest in this, it would be helpful for people as they think about this to know how, so people can do their individual math, how many watercraft are the smaller ones, the medium ones, the larger ones. So if people, we don't have to know that right now, but if you could just give us a little memo, we would share that with everyone.
I could do that. I actually do have those numbers if you'd like me to
okay.
say them.
Okay, want to just give them to members then?
Madam Chair, the canoe kayak category, there's about 181,000 of those. And I can get this to you in writing, too, so you don't take notes. But and then the watercraft less than 17 feet, there's about 337,000 of those. And then for the all other watercraft category, there's about 283,000 of those. We have about 802,000 registered boats or watercraft in Minnesota boats.
Members, questions about this? Oh, Representative McNamara, did you have a question about this?
Yeah, I did. And, Madam Chair, thank you so very much. I didn't realize they were going to come back in. I really appreciate you having them come back in. Director Hirsch, I was dumbfounded, actually, that the governor didn't include this. This is so much better than the general fund. It's the right thing to do. I think the boat owners realize it. And I'm not going to put you on the spot. It was a department initiative before, and I'm certainly hope that it was your wishes and you just didn't prevail with the administration. I'm curious, the numbers we see before us, are they annual or are they the 3 year? Because if I'm not mistaken, our boat stickers are for 3 years. Is that the annual bump or is that the 3 year bump?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, the 3 year bump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Director Hirsch, the canoe would pay $1.77 per year, or and it just seems like, Madam Chair, I hope, and I know you're probably going to be looking to tweak the governor's recommendation. I, for one, maybe there won't be many other on this side, but I believe this is kind of the second step. The first one was the game and fishing increase, and I see Representative Dill looking that he's interested in the issue. This, to me, is so much better than the general fund. This is not a one-time solution. This would be the ongoing solution that would be real. And boat owners, I think, for the most part, are willing to pay this. And I certainly hope, Madam Chair, that instead of the general fund, that we consider this.
Representative McNamara, I'm understanding you, and I just want to make sure I understand. You are talking about what I assume is going to be a dedicated fund, using this money in a dedicated fund for AIS. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, and I believe that would be the proposal. That was the way it was. If I'm not mistaken, Director Hirsch, last biennium, this was an initiative along with the game and fish fee increase that we were able to get passed. The game and fish fee we got it passed, not the AIS fee, but this was an initiative, and it is a dedicated fund, and it would really fill the gap that we did in one-time money last time.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, that's correct. And the current watercraft license surcharge and non-resident fishing license surcharge goes into the invasive species account, so our assumption would be that any increases to those would go into the same account, and that is a dedicated fund.
Madam Chair, could I just ask Director Hirsch, do you have real broad latitude in that? Could that be used to help with issues related like to the invasive Asian carp coming up the river and maybe some innovative ideas on how that money could be used? I'm assuming you have pretty broad range on that.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, we do have broad range to deal with aquatic invasive species issues with the enabling language for that dedicated account, correct?
Representative Kahn, and then...
Well, I want to join Representative McNamara in strongly supporting this, except I don't see why it can't be considerably higher. I would think $5, you know, if the money can be, and maybe not even as a dedicated surcharge. I think when you think about what the cost of boats are and what people's expenses are who use, I carried this once years and years ago. One of the things I pointed out was that the cost increase we were asking for was less than the six-pack that the person would routinely put in their boat each day and each time they went out and used it. And the other change I would like at this time, and I would like someone to get the data, which I know, you know, I know exists, and we haven't done it, is that one of the things that are exempt from this are boats that are under 10 foot in length, because we wanted, I thought at the time when we were doing this, you know, 100 years ago or so, that we wanted to exempt little kids' rubber rafts or something like that. But one of the things that I'm interested in is that very expensive kayaks turn to be under 10 foot, very often under 10 foot. And I think, again, the people buying those could well afford a watercraft fee. And so I think as we're changing that, I wish someone would check with the manufacturers and see what the reasonable size would be to get those into our list. Or maybe if we want to keep 10-foot length, put some description that would cover the expense of kayaks. And I remember several years ago when I did Friends of the Mississippi has a trip down the Mississippi River, I think I met. And several years ago when I did it, I was the only person in a kayak. The last time I did it, it looked as if most of the boats were kayaks. So I think we're losing out on a source of revenue for people who would happily pay for better access and understand that they need clean waters and so forth. So I don't know, thought of doing that at all, or you've looked at, if you have any better data than I do by just looking around as to what the size of boats we're talking about are and so forth.
Director Hirsch, one of the things that would be helpful, I think, for this committee is as you hear, and we do have some more questions, as you hear people's concerns and questions, if we could just have a chart that would say what is in each category, the current fee, and so people could do their own math by the side. Just, you don't have to make any projections, just tell us what is current so that people can figure it out. A little worksheet, is what I am suggesting. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of quick questions. How much of this $3.9 million would be dedicated to research, and where would that research take place? And how would you work with local groups, that lake associations and townships and so on? How would you work with them using this money to get their cooperation?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, we would not be using any of these dollars for research. The DNR has not had a research program for invasive species in general. We have supported research in some cases. There are a lot of other entities across the country, academic institutions, the United States Geological Survey, that are already engaged in a lot of research. And now we've got the newly funded Aquatic Invasive Species Research Institute at the University of Minnesota. So it has not been a priority for us to try to gear up. It would take millions of dollars for us to gear up and do good research for EIS, and we've been more along the lines of supporting the research for entities that are already kind of geared up to do that and have the expertise to do that. With regard to your second question, a lot of the money would be going to work with local units of government. We've got a grant program right now that for local units of government to help beef up their own inspection programs. We provide training and watercraft inspections. We would have 16,000 hours of watercraft inspections by local units of government that we would pay for with the current proposal, the $3.75 million in general fund, and it would be very similar if the source of funding was this. We also do, you know, our local field specialists are working with local lake associations and local governments all the time on aquatic invasive species, and these dollars would go to help continue to fund that. We also provide grants to local groups for control of invasive aquatic plants, and these dollars would help us continue that program in full force. So we would continue to be working a lot with the local units of government with these dollars.
And then just a follow-up, would you then be ramping up places that do not have a local association that you could tap into volunteer type of stuff? I'm thinking, for instance, the accesses on Red Lake. There's, I think, three of them. As far as I know, there's no monitoring there now, and I believe some of the major ones up on Rainy River and Lake of the Woods, again, don't have any local associations. Would some of this money be targeted towards those major walleye producers?
But Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, we would be using a lot of the money for our own watercraft inspection program. The main criteria, though, that we've been using the last couple of years for where we put most of our effort are the high-use zebra mussel waters. That's not all of it, but that's where we've been prioritizing our effort. That's where a lot of the concern is right now. So some of the areas that you mentioned, we do have some presence. Lake of the Woods has spiny water flea, for example, so we do have some watercraft inspection presence up there. But with the number of lakes in the state, you know, obviously we're not able to get to all of them. So our priority has been more along the lines of what are the high-use zebra mussel waters and high-use waters that are infested with other species.
And just one follow-up on these $25 for watercraft. If, you know, a lot of these boats and motors, the trailers that we see coming up there are in the neighborhood of $30,000, $40,000 worth of investment. $25 spread over 3 years doesn't seem like a overly burdensome amount. If these were to raise up, and as Representative Kahn was mentioning about these, you know, $10,000 kayaks or whatever they are.
Not quite.
Okay, well.
Thousands a little closer.
Thousands, okay. Not being a kayaker myself, I'm unfamiliar with it, but it just seems to me like, you know, even my boat that I purchased a couple of years ago when I thought I was going to have time to fish, you know, it was $20,000 that I spent on mine, and I think mine would fit into this $20 range. I'm just thinking that if these were raised to even 50% more or whatever, would you be able to effectively use that additional money?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, yes, we would.
And Madam Chair, I just point out that what we're talking about is the increase to the surcharge to the basic watercraft license fee. There is an additional basic license fee that all these watercraft are paying in addition to the surcharge. So when we are talking about the surcharge amount, that is in addition to that basic license fee for watercraft under 19 feet or less, for example, that would be $27 every 3 years. So you would need to add the surcharge and that basic license fee together to know what a boat owner would pay every 3 years.
Well, let me follow up on that particular question. One of the issues that I see is in ramps that just funnel the water right down to back into the lake, taking all the things that shouldn't be going into the lake from the road into the lake. With this surcharge, because you don't want water with invasives necessarily, well, you may, I don't know. Would this surcharge help us fix some of those ramps, or is that in the base fee?
Madam Chair, the surcharge could certainly be used for that. In fact, we did use some of the one-time funding for that this current fiscal year, about $500,000 worth are we in the process of using it. So we could use a surcharge for some of that. It would be, if we went with the same game plan that we presented with the governor's budget, it would still be a reduced amount if we're only getting in that neighborhood of 3.7, 3.8, 3.9 million, but we would be doing some of that. And I'm not sure about whether the base fee can be used for that. When Parks and Trails might know the answer to that question when they get up here. So,
okay, well, if we could check on that question too. Representative Erickson, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, Representative Hansen? Has there been any discussion of adding this fee to out-of-state boats coming in that are using ours that are not contributing to this? They may be contributing to the spread of these issues, and they're not contributing any amount to helping us stop them and enforce them. Has there been any discussion of putting these same fees for out-of-state boats?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, there has. We've not proposed it as a department. The non-resident fishing license surcharge does get at the out-of-state boaters that come in and fish, but doesn't get at the people that just come in to boat. When you're coming in from another state to boat, if you've got a boat registration or a boat license from the state you're coming from, you don't need to get Minnesota's boat license. So if you were going to have a mechanism to cover all out-of-state boaters, you'd have to find a way to have some additional fee that they would have to pay, because right now they don't need to buy Minnesota's boat registration if they're registered in another state.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hirsch, I was pleased to hear talk about prioritization, because I think if we do a fee increase, I know there's been some concern of even the one-time money, and we kind of talked about this the other night, of what are exactly the deliverables and what are the outcomes that come from that. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time when we're dealing with water quality talking about prioritizing and trying to prevent contamination or to restore. It's a little harder with biological agents rather than chemical agents, but I think there's a general concern about having, rather than just throwing the money at the problem, that we actually try to have some prioritization and implementing a plan. And Representative McNamara commented on the surcharge. This would match easily with outdoor heritage funds to protect, restore, and enhance fish habitat. So I think it could go together with potential other funding rather than relying just on the surcharge increase to make sure that lakes are protected, rivers and streams are protected. So is there a plan for prioritization, or is there some type of deliverable or outcome document or strategy that you have if you did get long-term ongoing money?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, there is, and I think the current plan with the, if we can maintain the amount of funding we have for the current fiscal year, in other words, replace all or most of those one-time dollars, then our current game plan is to have this increased enforcement presence and increased watercraft inspector presence with the increased authority that the legislature granted over the last couple of years. And as I mentioned the other night in committee, we've really only done this for one year now, this increased level of effort. And so we're going to need to do it for a couple more years to determine if we're getting the outcome that we want. And the outcome that we want is that, if you'll recall the chart that we had in our presentation, the amount of overland spread that's occurring, that's what we're trying to stop. Once zebra mussels get into a particular water body, they can drift around and float downstream on their own, and there's really nothing we can do that. What we can do something about is the overland spread. So that's the curve that we're trying to bend. And what I would say in terms of long-range planning is we need to give this another couple years to see if it's having an impact. And if it isn't, if the rate of spread is still about the same or goes up, then I think the state is at a crossroads and needs to determine if we're going to take the next steps to prevent, or if we're going to, you know, rely more on research and try to control
for, you know, in the areas these species get to. And if you'll recall, last year we submitted a report that showed the various costs of different, more comprehensive prevention strategies. So I think in a couple of years, if we don't bend this curve, that's where we're going to be at. Are we at the point now where we either have to put tens of millions or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars into a comprehensive program that's going to cover all the state accesses and somehow cover the other vectors too, or are we not able to afford that? I think that's the long range planning, at least as I've sorted it out in my head. That's how I've sorted it out.
Representative Dill?
Nope. Everything that was I was going to say has already been said.
Okay. Representative Dill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, if we're going to increase this, is $25 for this fee, what else does it cost to boat and or fish on our lakes and streams? What is the total cost? If I go take my boat out and decide to fish for the day, what's it going to cost me?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know if I can't give you a total cost. I'm not sure exactly what you want to include in that. But as Deputy Commissioner Shad mentioned, there are also boating registration fees that are in addition to the surcharge. What we could do in the table that the chair asked for is we could include those amounts too in that table, so you can get an idea of that. But you'd also, it depends if they're fishing, then they would need a fishing license, and so it really depends what you want to include in that total cost.
I would also like to know, you know, there's the added cost of getting the boat there, like a trailer, you know, depending on, you know, there's a difference in the axles and you can buy a lifetime or, you know, those types of things. You know, what does it cost me to go and enjoy a weekend of fishing in relationship to DNR?
Madam Chair, we'll include that in the information.
Representative Collins.
Oh, I just wanted to know if any state had charges, boat registration charges, boating access charges for people coming from another state.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, it's my understanding that there are some that do. I'm pretty sure the state of Wyoming, if you go there, you have to buy a sticker. And that sticker, I think it costs $10. I'm not sure about that. But that sticker, the revenues from it go to for aquatic invasive species management. I think there's probably a couple other states that do that too.
Yeah. You know, again, the only experience I've had with this is with the Wisconsin bicycle trail license that you need to get. I mean, one of the things you do is you could have stickers like this available at accesses points with a sign and not do a serious enforcement effort, but, you know, I think you'd probably get a lot of people just voluntarily doing it. I'm not saying make it voluntary. It's kind of saying that if you're bringing a boat in from out of state, you know, you need to get a sticker before you put it in, have the stickers available. But I guess what I'm saying, the voluntary aspect is not do a serious enforcement effort on it. It's just
say, Madam Chair, you asked the question if we could use those boat registration fees also for addressing AIS best practices at water access sites, and we can, and we are doing that as we rehab existing water accesses and build new ones. We are incorporating those best practices into those accesses with that source of funding.
Okay. Well, there's some that maybe need upgrading sooner than we have money for right now. Thank you all for this presentation. It gives members something to think about, and that's, I think that's what I've been hearing. So now we'll go on to the next part of what we had formally scheduled, and that is Parks and Trails Division, Cortland Nelson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Cortland Nelson, the director of our Parks and Trails Division. He's served in that capacity for about 10 years. He's a native of Minnesota, spent much of his career overseeing park systems in western states, and came back when Commissioner Merriam asked him to take over what was then the Division of Parks.
Just before you get started, members, you'll notice that you have two sheets on your desk. The colored one is missing a couple slides, so that's why there's a second one. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, members. Cortland Nelson, DNR Director of Parks and Trails. Just a quick overview of our division, particularly for those new members. As you can see on the slides, these are the higher order activities that we provide in our parks and trails system. But I did want to give you some of the numbers just to give you a context for what we're talking about. It'll make more sense when we get to our budget information. We have 76 state parks and state recreation areas. We have 25 state trails throughout the state with about 1,400 miles that are developed. We have 4,800 campsites throughout the state, not including 300 group and horse campsites. We have 22,000 miles of groomed snowmobile trails that largely get completed through our grant and aid process to local communities and the clubs. We have, to the recent presentation, Madam Chair, we have 1,500 of the 3,000 water access sites around the state, which is a large responsibility for all of the reasons you have just talked about. Commissioner Landwehr mentioned earlier that we have 2,700 structures and buildings in DNR. 1,600 of those are in parks and trails. And of those 1,600, about somewhat over 600 have some kind of historic nature, either from the CCC or WPA era, and take extra care and concerns. We have 62 state forest and day use areas that we manage along with our division of forestry. We have 1,300 miles of state cross-country trails. We have 33 state water trails. And I believe later on in this session you'll be hearing a little bit about the upcoming 50th anniversary of that program, which is we'll be celebrating later this spring. We have 900,000 overnight visitors in state parks. We have 2,500 miles of off-highway vehicle trails of several different types. And we have 350 fishing piers. So we got a lot of stuff. We have a lot of infrastructure. We have a lot of program elements that we are responsible for. And we'll be glad to go over those in a little bit of detail during the presentation, and certainly answer any questions you might have about those. This is the picture of our funding scheme and the history associated with our division. As you can pick up from the bar charts, maybe I would point out first on the extreme right at the top, those are the legacy dollars. And you have heard a lot about various legacy funds. This is the Parks and Trail Fund. The Met Council gets a big chunk, and we get the rest of it. And the money that we get either goes to our state parks and trails system or goes through us in the form of grants to Greater Minnesota for regional parks and trails projects. And I'll be going over that in more detail here in a few minutes. But that is the legacy component. The you will also see that there is a environmental trust fund component. Those were one-time dollars that we received in 12 and 13 from the legislature, for which we were thankful, to try and help us with some operational costs and resource challenges that we had. They were one-time funding. You also may, on the right-hand side, or I'm sorry, on the left-hand side, notice that in 01 and 02 there was an adjustment to our natural resource account, which is the purple, and the blue, which is our general fund. And that was simply an adjustment that was made by your predecessors to put our revenues into the natural resource account as opposed into the general fund. So we got that money coming our way at that time in terms of the revenues from our basically our camping and our day use. And as you have also heard from other divisions, you see the downward trend of that general fund component. and we certainly appreciate the governor's recommendation this year for a small piece of that, which we'll go over in a change order in a few minutes. But there is, similar to other divisions, that general downward trend. Okay. This is a pie chart that, if you look at those titles, it kind of represents what we do. We thought it might be helpful to give you a sense of where these dollars go. And this is an opportunity to explain a couple of things. Because of our legacy plan, the 25-year legacy plan that was completed a few years ago, we now arrange most of our work along the lines of the similar pillars that are in the legacy plan. And I'll explain that in a little bit. This, however, really looks at what is the overall 50,000-foot outcomes of the monies that we get. So on the big blue pie, piece of the pie, that's outdoor recreation. That's the activities that occur in our state parks and trails and our water access sites, and that's the dollars that are aggregated to provide that outdoor recreation service, which, of course, is one of the primary responsibilities that we have as a division. The outreach component, the yellow component, that is really our education, our interpretation, our marketing, all of those kind of activities that we have, and giving you a feel for what that makeup is from all sources of funding. The red component is the natural resource.
Excuse me for just a second.
Yes, ma'am.
When you're talking about that, that's where you would find, like, the naturalists would be in that park?
Madam Chair, that would be correct.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice to know what portion of that the naturalists are at some point. We don't have to know that now.
Yep. And then finally, the red portion, as I meant, is the resource management, the planning activities, and the acquisition and development. The green component is really our community partnerships. Those are the natural resource accounts largely. The off-highway vehicle dollars, the legacy grants, the water access sites in some cases that are located in communities, that about a quarter of our work, if you look at it from that point of view, is working on those partnerships, which is very much in line with our conservation that work principles and the activities that we have laid out. On the right-hand side of the slide, those are the objectives from our legacy plan that we use to really lay out where we focus our work and how we distribute our funds and the work that we try and accomplish. And I'm going to go over those now with the next four slides that we have. As an example,
if you could excuse me for just a moment, we're going to take questions as we go, and Representative Kahn has one.
Before we leave that slide, I'm interested in the community partnerships. I assume that's done by grants.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be true.
Do you have any kind of a cap on the grants, or do you look at each individual grant?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we have several different grant programs. Some of them require work, sweat equity. Some of them require a cash match. Some of them require some kind of a contribution, and then the legacy, based on the work that was done in the last legislative session, there is no requirement for the match.
No, I'm not. That wasn't my question. My answer is there any cap on the amount of money that's available for these grants?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, to my knowledge, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so.
There was one time, it was a program that LCMR did lots and lots of years ago. There was such an artificially low cap that in no area, you know, in no large park system did it make any sense to do any application for it. And sorry, I was just wondering if that was something that we wanted to look at. Okay, thanks.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nelson. The earlier slide, the one before this, you had the bar chart had federal funds, and I asked this to some of the other divisions, but with the sequester, is there any Have you received any information, or is there any indication of what loss of revenue potentially coming from the federal government because of the sequester, and is that money tied in with any other funds? What's the impact of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wouldn't have any information on that. In the Game and Fish Fund, there may be some ties to that set of activities. I think my larger answer would be we get relatively small amounts of federal dollars, and the only one that I could think of that might be vulnerable, and this is just off the top of my head, maybe Representative Dill would know, would be the coastal zone dollars up on Lake Superior. And I think that is one of the areas that might be vulnerable, but I certainly don't know. Okay. Members, Madam Chair, this is an example of our connecting people to the outdoors, to the question that came up earlier about some of our interpretive activities. We do conduct research both on-site as well as under contract with the U of M, and have a pretty good handle on what our visitors are looking for and what kind of experiences they want. And we use that to our advantage. If you look at that fourth statement there about how are we doing, that gives you some explanation about what we do with the dollars that come in. We do have a number of long and established programs that we provide in our state parks. With legacy dollars, we also added a new set of activities called the ICANN campaign, the ICANN program. As an example, we have ICANN Camp, and this is really aimed at members, those families and individuals who don't have that outdoor experience that has been built into their life. They tend to be single-parent moms. They tend to be people from other parts of the country, other parts of the world who come here, and they may be interested in an outdoor experience, but they really don't know how to do it. They don't have a historical background for that. So we have them register, and for a modest fee, they come, and working with our partners, we have them set up a campsite. We show them how to cook over a stove. We show them different components of the overnight experience, if you will. And that might seem a little bit unusual, but it actually, from our feedback that we have gotten from these individuals, it is very, very much appreciated. And we try and use that then as a method to get them involved in our outdoor world, whether it's other things that happen in DNR or particularly with our parks and trails activities. We also have I Can Climb, I Can Paddle, I Can Fish, and Archery in the Parks. And as an example of what we're trying to do to get new people involved in the outdoor experience, that is one of those efforts that has worked out quite well for us. We also know from our research, anticipating one of your questions, that many of the desires that our customers have is more assistance in activities, understanding activities that are going to be going on in parks and trails, and also with trip planning. People are busy. The soccer, dance, hockey phenomenon for that target market for us, the young families, we have to get into their thinking process, and we have to get on their radar, and one of the most important parts of that is assisting them with trip planning. So we have a number of online services and other activities that helps those families try and think through their vacation plans, making reservations, their activities when they're at our parks, and it has been strongly endorsed, and we will continue to expand that. But that is one example of what we're trying to do with connecting people to the outdoors, and you can see our profile is in the right direction. The 2011 numbers that you're going to see throughout this presentation, that always has an asterisk next to it, and that, of course, is the year that we had the government shutdown. We were closed for 21 or 22 days, and it happened to be in the middle of our busiest season, and so that's the anomaly to all of our statistics. The next strategic objective is acquiring land and creating opportunities. We have two examples here One is about the state trail miles developed, and this really shows a pattern over time and a challenge that we have internally. Of the 25 state trails that we have, those are established through legislative action, and we are given a corridor of which we then go to work and create a master plan, working with local communities and partners and special interest groups. When we're lucky, like with the Browns Creek Trail, we get a rail line that is one owner and goes from A to B, and it's on a relatively level plane, and we work our way through that. Occasionally, and more often than not, it is from A to B in some part of greater Minnesota. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of owners we have to work with. We have a number of challenges in terms of the planning sequence and finding enough owners who will work with us over time so that we can make a long run on a part of a trail development. The easy work has been done on these state trails. It is now getting more and more difficult to make progress from one community to another or from a state park to a town for those reasons that I have mentioned. So the progress that we've had over the last few years has been steady, but it is, as you will know from some of your constituents, difficult. And we have to work through those challenges. As was referred to in testimony in the Legacy Committee by some representatives of Greater Minnesota, there is a very, very strong interest on their part of working more closely with us. And so we will want to be coming back to you in the near future, I think, with some plans about how our state trails can be commingled in terms of management and activities and funding with some of the regional trails in order to move more readily and at a faster pace. On the fourth line down there, or the fourth underlined, where we talk about how are we doing, I mentioned Browns Creek State Trail, and we hope to have that ribbon cut this fall. That runs off of the Gateway Trail into Stillwater, a 5.9 mile trail that we're very excited about. I also want to mention that in terms of the next chart below, which is about state park acreage and boundary issues, we are members in an anomaly in terms of acquiring land in state parks. We have a legislatively established state park boundary for state parks, state recreation areas. These are geopolitical lines that you and or your predecessors have established that really lay out the dimensions of a park. And so in our vernacular, we use inholdings as the term to describe these owners of property who are within this state park boundary. That establishment does nothing to their ownership. They're not required to do anything. There's no hurdle that they have to leap. But in order for us to, when the opportunity comes about, to make an acquisition of property, that property has to be within that state park's boundary. And at many times, your peers will come to us and ask for an adjustment of a boundary. If it tends to be on the outside of that state park boundary, often a landowner will ask to be taken out of that boundary. If conversely, there is an interest by that landowner that they would like ultimately to have a portion of their holdings be added to the state park, then they will ask to have that boundary adjusted the other way. I only go into that level of detail just to explain to you that this graphic then represents that acquisition of land within the boundary. And for us, it is a both an opportunity and a challenge to try and work through that. We do have contact in a general way with a number of the landowners, and many, many, many of them say, no thanks, we're not interested. We do have some willing sellers that come forward and have a list that we work with, and we go through a process of evaluating the natural resource values, recreational values, the cultural and historic values, and then try and reach an accord and then go through the official acquisition process that begins with a fact sheet in DNR and work work with that landowner and then hopefully secure funding and move forward. We average about $1 million to $2 million a year on acquiring land in holdings with state parks on average. And before Representative Dill beats me to the punch, I would add that in the lower graph here in 2008, the 3,000-acre acquisition of Lake Vermilion is not added in there, and that's because of this boundary issue, Representative. We did purchase Lake Vermilion, and of course, from an arithmetic point of view or a mathematical point of view, it would throw the averages off, but I did want to acknowledge that in 2008, we were fortuitous to make that acquisition.
If Representative Kahn has a question.
Yes, I'm interested in this number of 25 trails and 1,400 miles developed. I'm interested in what's the, and also even, and combined with the issue of the co-management of state trails and regional trails, because things I'm most interested in is larger connected systems. So what do you think your budget is for undevelopment of trail, for needed for development of the undeveloped trail?
Madam Chair, Representative, let me answer that from beginning with a little bit different approach. There is about 2,500 miles authorized by the legislature. So the 25 state trails, the authorization is for the development of about 2,500 miles. We have somewhere around 1,350, 1,400 miles that are developed. So there is about 1,000 miles to go. In my mind, Representative, it's not a matter of how much money it would take. It's a matter of what tools can we and can't we use to acquire those trails. We cannot use eminent domain.
Wait a minute. You had 1 of the things I'm specifically interested is acquired and undeveloped mileage. I understand that the problems of acquisition is a separate, more difficult problem.
Madam Chair, Representative, when an opportunity comes for an acquisition, we have market values that Lands and Minerals uses for their appraisal, and there are always issues of access and egress and etc. It costs between $125,000 to $150,000 per mile to develop that trail on average. So if we get a 10-mile section that we can add, that would be something north of $1 million to finish the trail, and then the acquisition costs would be based on whatever that real estate assessment and evaluation was. And that varies around the state, as you might suspect.
Well, one of the fairly recently, within the last couple of years, trails, I think this is probably a regional trail, not a state trail, but and I'm not sure what the source of funding is, but the trail in the city of Minneapolis that connected, it actually eventually connects the Loose Line Trail to the river, river trails in Minneapolis, I think was about $1 million a mile. So $125,000 doesn't seem like too much to me. Then on this same issue, one of the issues that we've wrestled with for years, and I have not from a constituent, but from someone in that area, is the only state trail that's been built and left unpaved is the Loose Line Trail. What are we looking at paving the Loose Line Trail? And one of the things I understand is that the part of the local opposition around paving it, which I think was irrational when we're talking about a state trail, has vaporized or something, or at least been mitigated. What about the paving of the Loose Line Trail, which I have two interests. First of all, my last accident on a trail was on the Loose Line Trail because of the bad condition of that trail. And second of all, when you look at the usages of trails, if it were paved, you'd see a huge amount more of skiers, rollerbladers, and that kind of thing, and people who can't use unpaved trails. So where is that in the progression of trails to be paved?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. For the members who may not know, the Loose Line runs from the West Metro to Hutchinson, and And we are in the final stages, Representative, of finishing that western end and working with Mayor Cook and Hutchinson and his associates in that part of the world. And we'll have that hopefully finished this next year. So we're excited about that. But to your very point, Representative, it ends in the west. The asphalt will end in the west metro. And I believe there is a statute that prohibits the asphalt on that trail. And it's because of equestrian interests. And that was the resistance that came from those West Metro citizens a number of years ago. And we would be interested in solving that problem if we got some support in that particular area.
Well, as I recall, there is an equestrian trail that goes right along the bicycle trail. And I know that's a problem. You know, the hole I might have fallen into was maybe an equestrian person using the bicycle part of the trail. So I don't, but I assume this part that you're doing near Hutchinson is paved.
Mm-hmm.
So what's crazy is that you've got this trail that has the part leading up to it in the eastern part paved and the part going out of it in the western part paved, and this one chunk of section and a very heavy populated part not paved. And I'd like us to put that in our as we're looking at funding of trails, I'd like us to put a correction of that in our bill.
Perhaps, Representative Kahn, it would be good for you to put a bill in, and we will hear that so that people have an opportunity to comment on it. Be glad to hear it. One of the questions I have, as there are some folks that are interested and are not purchasing more land, and noting that Representative McNamara, I am talking to you, there are some folks that are interested in not purchasing so much land and not expanding our parks so much that we don't have the money to pay for them. Is there an opportunity to not limit the inholdings as they are truly inside a park, but along any boundaries where we are expanding parks, that it's not what I would call an, it may be an inholding of the boundary, but it's not an inholding of the park itself. Are there opportunities to change those lines that would be wise? I know that's a loaded question, but...
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I think I know where you're going with this. Every year, including this year, we have boundary adjustments in our policy bill that deals with lands. Those adjustments tend to be on the boundaries of the park.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are opportunities for us to achieve some lesser acreage, if I'm getting the heart of your question. It might be also helpful for some of the members to understand that one of our challenges and opportunities really is how this occurs within the state park boundary. And I'll give you an example from Maplewood. There is a 2-acre island in the beautiful lake, one of the lakes up at Maplewood, and it was privately owned. And for years and years and years, those landowners were not interested in dealing with us at all. It wasn't adversarial. They just always said we're not at all interested. Something changed in the family leadership or dynamic or whatever, and we get a call in October. It says, we're selling the island. Do you want it? Well, of course we want it. It's in the middle of the park, and it's this privately held island. That's more typical, members, of the kind of acquisitions that come about to us. It isn't an aggressive nature on our part, nor is it bold resistance by others. They don't have to sell to us. But it's when an opportunity comes about, something changes, and people feel as though they want to move ahead. There are also other cases, and maybe a little bit to what Representative McNamara has talked to me about previously, where that acquisition is not important to us, and we make those decisions. If there's no resource value, if there's no recreational value, we have turned down many opportunities for that. And I think on our list that we have this year, there's 11 or 12 that we would be interested in should the right circumstances come about. But that list Madam Chair, really is made up of a number of people, and they're all willing sellers. They have come to us. Mm-hmm. And so we find that narrow range of opportunity to work with them on acquisitions.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. First of all, you talked about the ICANN program and the fees and so forth. I'm wondering, do your fees cover your expenses in those programs, in that program?
Madam Chair, Representative, they do not.
And how much of a deficit then would that program be running at, if you wanted to call it that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we hire, I don't know that answer. We charge a modest fee to cover the day of operations for I Can Climb, I Can Climb, I Can Camp, etc. But there is the administrative overhead of staff who put the programs together. They don't cost a great deal of money. The staff that manage these tend to be seasonal employees, and they tend to work with our park managers and trail managers so that we avoid a lot of overhead. But at the same time, you know, there's certain inherent costs in putting these together. We try and reduce those costs with partnerships and donated equipment. So it's not a big concern at all to me right now. As they grow, then it will likely become something, particularly where I Can Camp, where you've got camping equipment and you've got other expenses that we have to cover, travel, one thing and another. The interpretive programs that we have in the parks, those are provided as part of our experience in the parks, and for the most part, we don't charge a fee for those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm all for trying to recruit more casters and blasters, because obviously we pay a large chunk of what goes on within the DNR. When you do your ICANN program, for example, and you talked about you do some fishing and so forth, are the youngsters who are in that, you know, what do they have? They're obviously, if they're young enough, they don't have to have a fishing license, but if you get some older people, where are they at with regards to requirements for a fishing license?
Madam Chair, Representative, within a state park, you're not required to have a fishing license, and we have free fishing equipment that you can check out, again, to just get somebody out and have them fish once and learn a little bit about that angling activity.
And Madam Chair, I'd add, we're hoping to create future license buyers.
I understand that, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. With regards to your acquisition of more land around state parks and so forth, and you talked about willing sellers, are the local government units also willing to, I'll say, take those lands off their local property tax rolls and so forth? Do you seek their input and, in essence, ask for kind of an approval?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're required to do that for boundary adjustments. Depending on the size of the acquisition, we may have conversations with local government. If it's an acre or two, generally we would not. But for boundary adjustments, we do have to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Since we're talking about activities in state parks, I just had to ask you, how is the geocaching program going?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's going very well. Every year it grows. We get more activity centered around that. Members, this is a treasure hunt tool that's electronic, basically. It's an opportunity for us to get people in the parks, and we have caches of information, and generally families will use the geocaching tools to find these caches, and it's another way to expose them to the out-of-doors and learn things about state parks. It's been very successful.
I've found about 10 of them, and keep it going. It's a new program.
Thank you.
Oh, great. Do you want to continue?
This is a corollary to the previous slide. This is also to have a continuous example about trails and trail rehab. We, as I was inferring in my conversation with Representative Kahn, we do have now trails that are 20, 25, 30 years old, and they need some serious rehabilitation. We have, as you can see in that fourth bullet down there, we have 100 bridges that are 100 years old. We have approximately 100 miles plus of trails that need resurfacing. And so like a highway system or like a sidewalk over time, things need to be fixed. And so we are at the front end of some of that work. When I started several years ago here, I don't think anybody brought up trail resurfacing to me. I was with a number of bike riders on an event with the Parks and Trails Council last Labor Day up at Maplewood State Park, and nobody talked about new trails. All of those riders talked about trail rehab and needing to fix this or fix that. So we're in that transitional stage, and we are using our legacy dollars, some of our legacy dollars, to do that trail rehab. We also have some other funds that we hope to achieve for that purpose. It's an effort on our part to both for the trails as well as for our built environment. I mentioned the buildings that we have. On any given weekend, we're a busy city with water, sewer, power, security, safety, and the operation of buildings. And we have lift stations that go kerplunk. We have water systems that fail. And so we have a constant need for those kind of issues. We, anticipating one of your questions, we do try and use a variety of funding sources for our rehabilitation. Some of them are very much targeted, like the federal dollars have to go to specific things. We also use bonding dollars. LCCMR has been supportive. We have our natural resource accounts, which I'll get into here in a couple of slides, and then also legacy dollars. And that is one of the healthy, good arguments that we have about our legacy funds. Certain individuals would like to see dollars go into acquisition. Others would like to see more dollars go into rehabilitation or programming. And as we get further in the presentation, I think you'll see that that good, healthy argument revealed. We also work with DNR on our asset management activities, which is a different word that is used in DNR basically for building rehabilitation. And we have a pretty strong sense of what the backlog is on this at another time. If you're interested, we can share that with you and give you a sense of what that backlog is.
Okay. Representative Fong?
Did you have a look at the concept of the trail fee, like for cross country skiing and like Wisconsin has?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would be interested in looking at that. I personally think that that is something that should be in place. We have motorized users who have bucked up for many, many years to provide dollars for their sport, and I think that this should be something that should be addressed. There is always the resistance to that in terms of local access and another fee and all of those kind of issues. But I do think the time is very appropriate that we consider that kind of a fee. And I think it would have to be on a statewide basis. The metro area, the collar counties, greater Minnesota, all of this are going to have this issue eventually of trail rehabilitation. And I think a fee targeted at rehab and related issues would be very smart.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Nelson, just a quick question regarding Jay Cook State Park. I happened to be up there over the New Year holiday and observed some of the extensive damage in Jay Cook State Park, and just curious about a status update as to the repair of that infrastructure.
Madam Chair, members, this was from the 12-inch rain last late July. The park was shut down for many, many months. Highway 210 was wiped out in two different places. Representative, if you were there in December, you came in from the west on 210 and probably observed where that first washout was. In great partnership with MnDOT, that they provided that repair, so the park did open up. You probably also saw the historic swinging bridge down along the river. That was wiped out, but we are in the process of doing the plans to get that rehabilitated. There were 12 or 13 small trail bridges that were destroyed in that episode south of the river, a few north of the river. We are hopeful to have everything up and running by late spring in terms of the trail system. The park is open, and we're back in business and very excited about coming out of that particular situation. It was a very, very quick turnaround, and appreciate the role that MnDOT and FEMA and the local leadership played in getting that park open so quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious about the cost and source of funds for the swinging bridge, and there's still a very large washout on the highway between the park headquarters and Oldenburg Point. What are the plans for those two, and where are the sources of funding?
Madam Chair, Representative, to your last question, we are working with MnDOT on that solution at the east end, and I think there's some discussions going on with MnDOT and the Carlton County and Duluth folks about the particular cost of that. It will be a 100-yard bridge if that is to be completed, and so the question is there another route? Is there a cheaper way to get that done? Is that eastern extension still needed? And we think it is, but that's exactly where we're at right now. There was some bonding money that came through the emergency funds that you folks did last spring. There was some FEMA money. I believe the swinging bridge is mostly, we have dollars in the account for that because we were planning a repair anyway. That goes back, as you know, to the CCC era, and it was due for an update. And so I think we're mostly covered on that. And Madam Chair, members, then this is the other driving force behind our work, which is coordinating with partners. As I mentioned earlier, we have about $19 million in grants that we use through various sources to send out to Greater Minnesota. That we have individuals who work full-time on this grantsmanship activity. We have a long history of working in this arena. To one of the earlier questions, as you can see by that fourth statement at the bottom, with our legacy funds, the portion that went out through our grant activities, we had 80 applicants for about $7.5 million in funding. I've got another slide coming up on how those dollars were spent and split, but I just wanted you to be aware that this is a very proud part of our work, and one that you and your predecessors have supported in a strong way. Almost all state dollars from some source. There's a little bit of federal money that comes in, but for the most part, this is all state dollars that go through us to partners in Greater Minnesota. This is a budget overview. You're familiar with the pie chart of the department, and this is ours in Parks and Trails, the biennial budget. We have a number of important components that are a part of this pie chart. If I could focus you first on the Natural Resource Fund, that's the big purple chunk, big purple piece. This includes those special accounts that are basically user fee driven, and that would be the off-highway vehicle account, the snowmobile account, the ATV, the water rec account. So money comes from users in one fashion or another, goes into the account, and then we spend it specifically and only on those purposes. We also have in the natural resource account our revenues from our day use and camping, and those are set by you based on our estimates of what we think the revenues will be. You appropriate those dollars to us, and then they go into our operations. We also have a small amount of environmental trust fund dollars. And again, a few federal dollars that are in that orange, small orange sliver. The special revenue funds, the medium blue or royal blue slice there, those are accounts that your predecessors set up to direct dollars from unique revenue opportunities within state parks, the sale of merchandise that we have in our system, the Douglas Lodge account, which is, of course, the famous Douglas Lodge at Itasca. We have cooperative agreements around the state and the revenues that come in from those. And again, most of those dollars are specifically targeted to a purpose, generally the operation of the system or the providing of interpretive or natural resource services. The Parks and Trail Fund, that is the legacy dollars, including the grants, so that's the money we get. for the division, for our purposes in Parks and Trails, and the grant monies that go through us, as I just reviewed, in Greater Minnesota. The general fund component you see there also in the dark blue, and we have referenced that earlier in terms of the importance that it is for us. I would add parenthetically, members, that the general fund was established for the state park system basically. And so over the decades, that's where those dollars went for the operation of state parks. And so the impact of the downsizing of the general fund dollars has a disproportionate impact on our state parks operation and services. A little bit on state trails, but it's mostly on state parks. So in our references to the impacts of the general fund, you'll see that analogy as we move through the rest of the presentation. Okay.
Representative Bacon, did you have a question?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. it would be useful for me. We're getting a snapshot here. Eventually, I'm assuming we're going to get a spreadsheet where we get a more detailed breakdown of each of these different items within the funding.
I'm sure that's going to happen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, this is our first change item. This was what I referred to earlier in terms of a general fund increase as recommended in the governor's budget. We have a great opportunity here to hold our own over the next couple of years. We're very appreciative of that. We will keep our level of camping sustained. Our day-to-day operations will be continued. We will deal with the highest order maintenance issues. We will not have the dollars to do more, but we will deal with those high priority assets. The resource management activities will continue. And I want to make a point about that last bullet about efficiencies in the system, members. Over the last couple of years, we have made significant changes to the way we operate. We have reduced our spring and fall camping at parks where the use was very light and we had expenses, generally seasonal. And so we have made that change at 18 state parks throughout the state. We have created administrative centers within our system. And what that means is that we have Keystone Parks where we have a administrative service, we have full-time staff, and we are moving our business activities to those centers from other parks. So the business activities will be done for a variety of parks and area offices in order to have greater efficiency. It also provides us with an opportunity to use IT improvements, information technology improvements that have occurred in our state of Minnesota system, and to coordinate better our resource management activities. My point is that these are cost containment efforts. They were done for the right reasons. We made them really from a permanent point of view because we think that you and the citizens and the governor have asked us to do things in a different way. And when you're interested, I can provide you some greater detail on what we have done. Also, in the numerics of this, we've eliminated about 20 full-time positions last year and this year and moving into FY14. These will be handled basically through attrition and transfers. So an individual who is a full-time position in a park or a area office, when that position is open, then we will have those administrative responsibilities handled in another place. And we will be hiring seasonals to do those administrative responsibilities handled in another place. And we will be hiring seasonals to do the work in the spring, summer, and fall. So we'll be hiring more seasonals. We will be having less full-time people managing in our system. With the singular exception that in some of our larger administrative offices, we will need more financial assistance. It is becoming ever more clear to us with the complexities of our state of Minnesota world, big finances, $15 million plus or minus that move through our system, the IT requirements that we have, that we're going to have more people, a small group, but more people working full-time on this plethora of administrative responsibilities, and in a yet-to-be-defined way, we'll have to do a better job of that. But just wanted you to know that we are very much aware that we need to do more with the dollars that we have. Again, this hits disproportionately in the general fund area, and so we're trying to navigate and work our way through that, but we're very aware that we have a responsibility for cost containment wherever we can.
Representative Fabian has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the attrition part, but then the transfers that you mentioned, would that just be shifting those costs from Parks and Trails to some other division within the agency?
Madam Chair, Representative, I probably misspoke. In your area, Lake Bronson is a park where we manage Hayes Lake, we manage Old Mill, and all of the administrative responsibilities are taken care of there. We have some on-site work that we do in the spring, summer, and fall. But the transfer is really to that administrative center, not outside of the division.
Thank you.
We'll continue.
The next change item is a technical one, and this has to do with our reservation system. And it'll take just a second to explain, Madam Chair. For many years, we've had a reservation system in place. We had a new contractor that received the bid last year. You may have noticed that in the news for a few weeks when our reservation system failed, and we were the subject of much discussion and news. I'm very pleased to report that it has turned out to be very successful. We're very pleased with our vendor. I can't remember the last time I got a complaint about the reservation system. That said, and to the point of this change item, in the old system, the previous vendor received all of the dollars and then paid the state after they had taken their money out. We turned that around in this bid. So we receive all the dollars, and then we will pay the vendor for their services rendered. And so this account is to receive those dollars so that we can then pay the vendor based on the work that they have performed. Okay. Madam Chair, this is a small item, but one that's important to us. We have a cross-country ski pass that was mentioned earlier by the Commissioner in his presentation. This is our request to set up an account for our state park system itself. This is not the grants that goes out to the communities. We have used dollars generally from the general fund over the years to do our grooming. We would like to get dollars from the cross-country ski account that can be used at our 14 or 15 high-profile cross-country ski providers in the winter. And so these dollars are aimed at that. This would augment the grant and aid program that we have that goes out to the communities as part of this program. And then finally, the local and regional trail grants. These are lottery in lieu dollars, and it's at a small level, but it provides us an opportunity to get a few grants out for local and regional trails. And this is really aimed at that local provider who is looking for some financial assistance to finish a trail from point A to point B to do some improvements. It's a very modest number, but it does provide some capacity for those local applicants. And it does require Representative Khan a 25% match. This would be an example of one of the unique grant programs that we have.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Before we leave this presentation, Mr. Nelson, back early you mentioned fishing piers that the DNR has, and one of the lake associations back in my district, at least one of them, has mentioned that they have tried to work with the DNR and use your plans or blueprints, but to do their own volunteer labor and material to build a fishing pier, which of course would be much lower cost, but they couldn't do that. Could you explain why?
Madam Chair, Representative, from your description, I'm not exactly sure what the barrier would have been. We provide funding, the dollars come from the Fish and Game account for the fishing pier program. We have, I think, a focus on our own part of that system, because a third of the fishing piers, so this would be roughly 300 and some of the thousand, are in the metropolitan area in greater Minnesota. I'm not sure what that barrier might have been. I can certainly check on that, maybe meet with you afterwards and get some specifics and get you some information. It's a small but important program, and again, to Deputy Director Shad's point earlier, this provides that easy fishing opportunity that in most cases are also ADA accessible for those individuals who want to have a close-to-home fishing experience and don't have the boat and the gear and the travel time and all the rest of that. That's really the target for that.
I'll meet with you later. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in regards to the Red River Regional Park up in East Grand Forks, is there any possibility to do some expanding? They're full all the time, and wondering where you're at with that.
Madam Chair, Representative, we'd like to speak with you after the meeting if you've got a few minutes to talk about that. It's a for the members' understanding, this is in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, and we hire the city of East Grand Forks to do the operation and maintenance. They have put in some capital dollars over the years to expand. It's the old residential area of the city that was flooded in the floods of the mid-90s. And so we have had various funding dollars that have gone into that to rehabilitate it. It is very successful from a point of view of the occupancy rates. And I think that's to the heart of your question. We have some larger issues that we have to deal with in terms of how that compares and contrasts with some of our other needs in the system, and that's what we'd like to chat with you about if we could.
If you could help us out a little bit here. Are you talking about a state park or a regional park or a local park here?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a state recreation area, so it's part of the DNR.
Okay.
And there are several hundred acres, and it runs along the Red River, and it's a trail system and a campground and a couple of major structures.
Okay, that's fine. I just wasn't understanding at the beginning. Representative Dillon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I want to say how much I appreciate, you know, we have a lot of trails up there that are used by many. I really want to thank you for the work that you do up there. Not very often I'm really that complimentary to the DNR, so you might want to write that one down. What I wanted to ask about, if we kind of glossed over for a minute, is the grant aid account for snowmobiles particularly. And earlier this summer, I got a call from Mr. Meyer that talked about a reduction in the amount of funds. And so we're one of the things we talked about then, in the current biennium, a reduction in the funds of the last payment to the club. And I said, wait a minute, we don't want to move that quickly because it hasn't snowed and, you know, it's going to be February. Well, now we've had abundant snow, and I'm wondering, has it caught up? I know I went in my garage, and I realized when I looked at my garage that I had two snowmobiles sitting there that I couldn't ride until I bought trail stickers, and of course I did. And, so an update on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that very much was a concern. We were worried about that account going into the red. We made the changes that you're talking about. We felt an obligation to notify the sponsors and the clubs that there was this eventuality that may come along. We have taken some decrease expenditures on the DNR side, and we were asking the clubs to take a decrease potentially on the outside. Things are looking more promising. I can't tell you that where we're at as of this month because I don't know what happened with the registrations. What the representative is referring to, that if there's no snow, there's a certain percentage of people that don't register their sled for that winter. And once that sled gets registered, then that money is in movement to us. So we are feeling much better than we were a month ago, certainly 2 months ago. I'm understanding that at the MinUSA conference a couple of weeks ago that there was some better feeling in terms about the financial situation with that account. I would hazard to say, Representative, that we probably need to take a longer look at that in the off session and maybe come back along with MinUSA next year to see if we need to make some adjustments to the expenditures in that count and the distribution as we hit more variable snow conditions year to year. As you know very, very well, That's what creates the issue, and we would be interested in everybody's thoughts about how to more appropriately manage that.
And Representative Bill.
Thank you. And then secondly, something I haven't heard much about. Some time ago, the agency implemented because of some controversy, actually some of it was around me back in 2004, being a trail administrator and a state representative and those kinds of things. You implemented, I'm not going to take full credit for getting that done, but you implemented an audit system for the club.
Yes.
Statewide. It came in and looked, it did the trail. I had my easement, I had my audit for our system, and I got a dozen roses from somebody for doing such a good job. But anyway, how has that gone on a statewide basis for compliance purposes? And one of the things I think that happened that brought that along, there was a feeling in the legislature by some that we were just given the money and that we just spent it and that there was no accountability. Tell me about that, because I think I haven't heard much about that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm glad you haven't heard much about that. That would indicate things are going well. I know of one case where, because of the audits that are required, we do them in the off season, working with the sponsors and the clubs, and we had to make some changes. We had to have some additional requirements because a lack of action and a lack of management on the part of both the sponsor and the clubs. That being said, I don't know of any issues that we have had with regards to any other problems with the use of those dollars.
One last question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that has always intrigued me about, particularly up in the Northeast, or in my area that I'm the most familiar with, is the duplication of services. The organization that I'm involved with and manage the trail, we have three grooming tracks. And the state has the corridor trail, like in many other places in the state. And we just think that the state could better use their resources somewhere else and make some type of an arrangement, because the trails that we have connect and are spurs out to communities. And I'm going to give you examples: International Falls, Captogama, Ash River, Crane Lake, Orr, and Cook. And every organization that has a trail that surrounds the state highway for snowmobiles has adequate grooming capacity, because none of the clubs have enough trail, which could be hundreds of miles, to use the full potential of the equipment that they have. And so I see the department going up and down the highway and the clubs working off on these significant spurs, and I just see that that's an area where either you take those resources, turn it over to the clubs with performance guarantees, and take your resources and move them somewhere else where they can be better used. And I've been on this for a long time, but I've run into different problems. I just wonder, are we ever going to get there and try and to be more efficient?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's exactly the kind of issue that we need to talk about in the off session and see if we can readjust the allocation of those dollars based on that principle.
And just a comment, Madam Chair. You know, the fact that my first question was about the account balances in the fund. Now, the DNR gets to the same supper table as the clubs do when it comes to the pot. And if we can be more efficient, that takes the pressure off of when the years that we don't have the snow and we don't have as many registrations coming in. So I really think that that's something that we need to really move forward on. And again, this isn't a general fund activity, so it kind of gets off on its side and out of the sight of most members. Thank you.
Members, at the beginning, and some folks weren't here, we do have a meeting scheduled tonight. I am going to recess, but if anyone says to me during the day, the snowstorm that I'm thinking about seems to be dissipating a little bit, but who knows about snowstorms. If anyone does not want to meet tonight, then you don't want to meet tonight.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Pardon?
That is correct, Madam Chair. I do not want to meet tonight.
Okay, well, so we will then adjourn for today, but we will schedule then. We're not scheduled for next Thursday night, and we will schedule for next Thursday night to get this work done. So we just can't do anything about snowstorms, but we do have to get our work done too. Would you want to talk about the minutes,
Madam Chair? I move approval of the meeting minutes from the meetings of February 12th,
February 14th and February 19th.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? The minutes are approved. The meeting is adjourned.